This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Pacific War of the 1940s. That victory was possible because of acts of Congress and the Roosevelt administration in the 1930s. Why? Because they built the arsenal of democracy to sail the seas and take the U.S. from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. I welcome Elbridge Colby. Elbridge is a colleague of mine for many years, the author of The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. Most recently, however, he and his colleague, Mr. Gray, have published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal identifying that the arsenal of democracy is long gone and it needs reawakening. Bridge Colby served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Development. His colleague served as Special Assistant to the President for the Defense Industrial Base and Chief of Staff of the National Security Council. So they're drawing on information that's very fresh, though they're both knowledgeable of the arsenal of democracy once upon a time. Bridge, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. The industrial base didn't exist in scale in 1936 and 38. It was working its way. And in 1940, the Two Ocean Naval Act, imagined building the industrial base from the East Coast to the Gulf to the West Coast. Your case today, is America ready for that scale of building? And what do we need to do to get there? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. It's a great pleasure to be back on with you. Always an honor to be with you and your listeners. Well, we're not anything close to where we were then, unfortunately. The biggest difference, I would say, from then to now is that at the time, you know, while we might not have been a very significant military power in the interwar period, we were by far the world's largest industrial power, what was often called the Detroit deterrent, the ability to produce huge quantities of, you know, military industrial equipment very quickly and often at quite high quality. And so that's, you know, unfortunately, we've gone through, you know, generations now, I suppose, of deindustrialization. That's for multiple reasons. And I should pay homage to my great friend and colleague in this effort, Alex Gray, who not only was chief staff of the National Security Council, but was a specialist on the defense industrial base. So he has tremendous depth there. But yeah, I mean, it's a much different situation, but the simple, you know, I mean, we can analyze how we've gotten here and that's important. But I think the main thing that Alex and I wanted to draw attention to here was simply the fact that we have to remedy it. I mean, you know, there has been a sense, I think the Ukraine war has laid that to rest a little bit, but it's still out there, that modern wars would be very high technology and short and decisive. That's possible, but it's an imprudent assumption. I think what we're seeing in Ukraine is that, you know, frankly, good old-fashioned industrial-scale production is critical. Often you run out of the very sort of kind of boutique, high-end, you know, munitions and platforms, or you have to withhold them because they're too scarce, takes too long to build, and you go back to, you know, what the Russians are doing and that have gained considerable advantage from, which is, you know, simply the ability to produce large numbers of artillery shells, and they may not be as accurate as the best weapon right now, but sometimes the perfect is the enemy of the good, and the good will do. And we need to be in that situation because particularly if we get into war with the Chinese, God forbid, but it's a very serious possibility, including in this decade, we're going to need to be able to churn out stuff, you know, quickly and at scale. But again, the problem is, you know, in 1940, we were the world's largest industrial power. China's now the world's largest industrial power. We were the world's largest shipbuilder in the 1930s and 1940s. China is now. So this is a huge problem. But again, we just have to grapple with it because it's necessary for our security and ultimately our freedom and our prosperity.
The 1940, 1938, 1936 acts achieved something without digitalization, without robots, without modern communications. I mentioned that by the time of 1944 and the retaking of the Philippines, Task Force 58 had 15 task force carrier groups. 15. 15.
It's amazing. 15. It's really incredible. Right.
And they
I think there were over 100 aircraft carriers of various types. I could be wrong about that. There were something like 15 fleet carriers, but there were dozens and dozens and dozens of escort carriers and smaller carriers. I mean, it's really staggering.
And the war started. Nobody understood the aircraft carrier was the weapon of choice. They thought it was the big gun.
Except the Japanese. They got it.
They transformed their thinking, and we'll probably do that again in a conflict right now. But Bridge, you have some wonderful details here that are very helpful. Tell me about the long tail that we need to attend to.
Well, sure. I mean, let's go back historically. I mean, one of the key elements, really key elements of victory in the war, and particularly victory in the Pacific, was combat logistics support. I mean, look, there's this idea out there that's kind of fashionable that everything is now zeros and ones and military power is not zero sum. That's not serious. Today, as much as 50 years ago, you have to project kinetic force in space and time. And that involves energy, you know, generally speaking, oil, if it's not nuclear power, which is, you know, relatively only a few platforms use nuclear power. It's things. I mean, missiles exist in space and time. Shells exist in space and time. Bullets exist in space and time. And they need to be carried across. They need to be sustained. Forces need to be fed. You know, they need to be housed, et cetera. And so if you look at, I mean, you mentioned those 15 task forces. Well, there were huge, huge hundreds and thousands of ships and other platform bases that were sustaining those forces forward. That was, in a sense, what was perhaps the most remarkable thing about particularly the American war effort was our ability to sustain forces forward at this scale. And so that's going to be necessary again, but that is really atrophied. In some ways, the parts of the American military, ironically, that have maybe atrophied more than most are actually these things that used to be our strong suit. I mean, this logistics stuff. We do have the ability to sustain forces forward. I mean, look at what we were doing in the Middle East, but in a much more kind of just-in-time, you know, sort of exquisite way. I mean, I remember as a civilian serving in Iraq in 2003, and, you know, we were being fed with, you know, all these kinds of things and so forth. But the idea of a combat logistics force under attack at range by Chinese forces, that's something that we're not really prepared to do. And that's a huge problem, because if you can't support them, it doesn't matter. Because, you know, the way we put it in the piece was you're potentially, you know, a fantastic Super Bowl level football team, but one that can only play the first quarter. And, well, you know, there's going to be four quarters in a football game. If the Chinese know that we can only play through the first quarter of play, they're going to outlast us and we're going to lose. So this logistics force and this kind of scale that we need to generate is absolutely critical. It's less sort of romantic, but, you know, the old expression goes, amateurs talk strategy, and I talk strategy a lot, but amateurs talk strategy, professionals talk logistics.
Yes, let's talk logistics. In reading your piece, I've recently talked to a professor at emeritus at Annapolis about Chester Nimitz, who commanded the Pacific Fleet. And it occurred to me, putting these two matters together, that building beforehand changes the nature of the adversary's battle plan. Japan knew, Yamamoto knew, they only had 6 months to win the war, that is, to bring the U.S. to a bargaining table and right. Divide up the Pacific. He knew about the naval acts of 36, 38, and 40. He knew what was coming online. So he rushed himself. He rushed himself into what we remember as Midway. He made a strategic mistake because the arsenal of democracy was going to deliver those carriers that he could not match going forward. Do you measure, Bridge, that in Beijing there is an admiral or a series of admirals who are saying the same thing to themselves? If they put together that infrastructure, our war plans have to change.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a secret. I mean, they're openly discussing like the Battle of Midway and lessons from the Second World War, in their you know, sort of open literature on military stuff. I mean, I think the really sobering thing is that Yamamoto's plan was extremely aggressive and risky, but it wasn't completely crazy. There was something to it. But they were, you know, outclassed by the United States 10-1, and we had an enormous industrial base compared to them. It's not so crazy for the Chinese to think they could pull something like that off, because if they do run, you know, rampant through, you know, the sort of the Pacific, particularly the Western Pacific, as the Japanese potentially did, unlike the Japanese, China would be in a position where their economy is the same size as ours, as opposed to being one-tenth the size. And they have the world's largest industrial base. In fact, the Wall Street Journal was just reporting today that, you know, China's share of global manufacturing has actually increased since the pandemic. So that's what really scares me is that actually this would, you know, I mean, the Japanese, the Tokyo's decision is sort of famously studied because it was sort of manifestly, if not irrational, really pushing the boundaries of rationality. China's decision in that respect would not be clearly irrational at all. It might actually be quite sound. And that's a terrible position for us to be in. So, you know, I'm trying to get ahead of this problem, because, again, the point is, if you're in Beijing and you say, well, the Americans are, you know, thin on the bench, they, you know, they're a great first quarter team, but if we outlast them, you're much more likely to think it's a sound policy to pursue, you know, aggressive military action. Whereas if you say, yeah, these Americans, we could probably take them down, you know, in the first quarter, but geez, they've really upped their game. Now they can last through the whole game. That's going to be a different calculus. You're more likely to say, it's just not worth it. It's too risky.
Are the Navy think tanks apprised of this weakness, and are they applying to Congress to get moving?
Well, candidly, I think the Navy and the sort of navalist community is very aware. And I say this with all due respect to my navalist friends, but I think a lot of people, and I say this a bit as a sort of more of an amateur on amateur, but I, you know, I'm not a Navy person or that kind of thing. So I'm certainly less expert than a lot of people. But I would just say that I think this argument, in my sense, my gut sense, has tended to be marginalized as special pleading for the Navy and the military, as seen as kind of like, you know, the phrase self-licking ice cream cone, or one of these bureaucratic phrases, you know, just trying to feather your own nest. And that's not true. I mean, there may have been some of that going on, but the fundamental facts as we lay them out as a nation are such that we can't afford to have this. And this is not about, you know, building a Navy with X number of ships or whatever. This is about, we just need to have the industrial capacity to take on our most significant great power opponent. And that's not where we are. And it's not just about the Navy. I mean, it's about the Air Force. You know, I mean, we have 20 B-2s right now, something that I can't remember the exact number. It's about 20 or 19. It's one crashed, I think, in the last year or two. That's not many. I mean, the B-52 is still flying. We need to be able to report. I mean, a lot of those are going to get shot down. You know, it's true for the Army, munitions, et cetera. So this is not a single service thing. This is across the services. But I mean, the Navy is a more high capital intensive service by definition. But I mean, just to give an example, the Navy confessed a couple months ago, I can't remember the name of the 3-star admiral, that the Navy is not in a good position to, or at least it was in the Naval Institute Press, but I think it's very well sourced, the Navy's not in a position to repair ships damaged in combat. I mean, you know, one of the things about that surprised the Japanese was they would knock out, I mean, the famous story of Midway, of course, and I think it was the Yorktown, right, which had been damaged to Coral Sea.
Yes, it was Yorktown.
And then, you know,
they did it. In
so the Japanese thought, I think the Japanese thought they'd sunk it, but at minimum, they thought it was going to be out of action for a long time. And boom, there it appears out of nowhere, you know, a ghost ship kind of thing at Midway.
Right.
And that was a critical variable. So, I mean, but that's that kind of, you know, industrial capacity. I mean, all those, I mean, that was the result of having tremendous numbers of skilled tradesmen, you know, managerial talent and competence that could turn around a ship with literally like a hole through the flight deck and like that, I think, exploded below decks, you know, that could be repaired and be, you know, basically fully operational within a couple of days. So that's, we're a far cry from that, but that's where we need to be.
Elbridge Colby is a principal at the Marathon Initiative. He is the author, most importantly, of The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Bridge about his book and lessons learned from the recent threats to Taiwan. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.